Afternoon, everybody. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for John Williams. I'll be in tomorrow, 9 to 1 as well. So 2 days of the business lunch and some other time as well. Very nice to be here. It is a crazy Thursday. Seems like we say that every time that I'm on the air because it really is. The Dow is down right now about 765 points. Apple having its worst day since March. Tesla, which had been on a tear, is seeing a three-day drop near somewhere around 20%. So the stocks, the eight companies like Google and Facebook that have been pushing the stock market to incredible record highs, falling back a little bit after touching an all-new high yesterday, and certainly having a great time this year. Pete Zimmerman is producing us today, which is very nice, as he always does. And we've got a great show for you coming up in a couple of minutes. We've got Ian Schur, editor-at-large of CNET. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on with no ads. A bunch of the big companies like Facebook and Pinterest, of all places. I never think about Pinterest as being a place that has a lot of political ads going on. But, yes, they also, along with Facebook and Twitter and a bunch of others, are now going to forbid and not publish any ads, election ads, in the week before the election, which is remarkable. As we keep saying, it's the most overused word of the year, I think, is the word remarkable. Weekly jobless claims, you've heard as we started the show from our friend Steve Bertrand, who we'll get back to in just a moment, totaled 881,000. Better than expected, but don't get so excited that this is a big drop from last week, which was at about 1.2 or 1.4 million. This is the first week that the Federal Reserve and sort of the others who monitor this stuff, there were changes in the calculation. And so if you had calculated the unemployment number at exactly the same way that we had done it last week, the first-time claims would have been 1.02 million as opposed to 881,000. So that's a huge swing of 20%, and it makes it seem like it's great. But let me reassure you, it's not great. And if you add in the 769,000 first-time claims for PUA, that's for contractors and other people who just don't normally qualify for unemployment. That number, by the way, was up 169,000 from the prior week. Altogether, it's not a great first-time unemployment claims week. I just don't want anybody to get too excited that we've turned the corner on this. And even if 881,000 is the right number, right, there's a lot of fluctuation in that weekly number because it happens so quickly. Week after week, it's a little bit better on the sort of monthly side. We're definitely making progress, so don't get me wrong, but 881,000 is still worse than any week that we've seen unemployment claims through the Great Recession from 10 years ago. I think the worst number there might have been like almost 700,000. This was 881,000 or maybe 1.02 million, depending on how you look at it. So, yes, trending in the right direction. No, not quite there yet. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the new companies that have announced that they will be doing layoffs a little bit later in this show. And then, of course, tomorrow, as we have on Mark Hambrick. Welcome back, everybody, to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink. You hear me with John on Monday and filling in when he takes some time off, which he is today and tomorrow. I will be back tomorrow, 9 to 1 as well. You can find me offline, online, at thinklink.com or bestmoneymoves.com, or feel free to link in with me, tweet, whatever, answer on all social media. We've got Ian Schur with us right now. He's editor-at-large at CNET.com. There are so many interesting things going on right now. Ian, welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. There we go. Ian, you there?
Hi.
There we go. Now I gotcha. My goodness. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, you can hear my son trying to get into the door. He is at home and wanting to join our conversation, but the door's locked.
You know, I have to tell you, that sounds so familiar, because when I was young and on the radio, younger, I should say, and raising my kids, who are now, you know, like in their early 20s, but they also would be pounding on the door. And I'm like, Mom is working. Mom is live on the radio show. I'm feeling for you, Ian. Absolutely.
Yes. There seems to be some sort of a thing I send out, like this eminence that I send out telling him, hey, I can't be bothered. And that's when he knocks on the door.
Hey, it's the pheromones of parenthood, I think is the only thing we can say about that. Well, while we have a quiet moment with him, and I'm sure he's totally adorable, so you should send us a photo. We'll post it on WGN.
Absolutely. Not knocking on the door.
Yeah. So one of the things that's super interesting to me is all of the tech companies, the biggest tech companies like Microsoft and Google and, of course, Twitter and Facebook, they are talking about fighting deep fakes for the election season. You know, we've seen as technology gets better and better, we're seeing just an incredible amount of what I would consider to be fake news videos, real fakes, emerging. And these are getting pushed by everybody in the political realm. And Microsoft, you wrote a story today about Microsoft fighting these deep fakes. What are they doing? What have they introduced for that?
Yeah, they have two new technologies that they've been working on. And it's worth remembering Microsoft's history and a lot of the stuff. They invented an app called PhotoDNA that's used by a lot of law enforcement to help actually track child pornography across the web. And so there's a history here of them trying to build technologies that are designed to help basically with law enforcement and protecting democracy in a lot of ways. And they actually have a program called Defending Democracy. So in this instance, deepfakes, which if you've never heard of them, you should go on CNET and watch, are these videos or audio files that are designed to be manipulated by a computer to make someone look like they said or did something that they didn't actually do, often without their permission. So imagine, for example, making President Trump say something on a video that he didn't actually say and stuff like that. It's rather amazing, and it's really gotten advanced these days. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology spent 6 months creating a version of Richard Nixon that they were able to actually give a speech that he never actually gave.
This is just...
It's rather amazing. So Microsoft says they've developed technology to identify a deepfake. So this is one of the hardest things, is actually identifying when they happen. And then the other thing that they've done is they've created an authentication program where video makers like you guys at WGN or us at CBS and CNET can upload videos to a database. And then the fingerprint, there's an individual kind of data fingerprint for every video, gets created and then authenticated every time someone watches it. So they could have, let's say, a little button on their computer that's green when they know it's definitely been an authenticated video, and then maybe it's not green when they don't know for sure.
Which I think is really incredible. It's sort of interesting. I think back to the old Speed Racer cartoon. I mean, I am showing my age here, but when I was a little kid, Speed Racer was on, and their mouth was always moving at a different speed than the actual, you know, voice that was coming out. And this was just a cartoon. But today, you know, when you're looking at live action, what we would call live action, which is actually, you know, real people, like as if you took a video of me now, and instead of talking to you, it makes my mouth move, right? These are all digital bits and bytes, and they can sort of remove it so and remanufacture almost so that it looks like I am saying something that I never said. It is very believable. This stuff you feel like you're watching your eyes. You have to be able to trust what you're seeing, but seeing is not believing, right?
Right. I mean, it's like Photoshop, the way that it changed the way we thought about photos for a long time. And like I mentioned, that Nixon speech that we have on CNET's rather amazing. Yeah. There's another one someone did recently of taking The Shining and taking Jack Nicholson out of it and putting Jim Carrey's face into it instead. And it looks like he shot the film. And it's incredible what this can do. So, of course, a lot of people wonder, well, why even go through this, right? Like, it seems like so much trouble, and it can cause so much damage to democracy. And the reason is because the entertainment industry could benefit so much from this. If you watched Solo, a Star Wars film that came out, what, 2-3 years ago? And that had a version of Princess Leia that was completely CGI, and it didn't look that great, right?
Right.
And if they'd used deepfakes instead, it would have looked so much better, and it would cost them so much less money and so much less time. And that's the promise, right, is to really change the way entertainment works.
Right, which is also a little bit frightening because if you can do that digitally, you don't need to hire people to do it. right? So
yes.
how many actors do you actually need? Well, we need one. You know, they started working. We actually don't need any, but we're going to license their appearance, which is, again, far less expensive than hiring people to do it. And they started this back with tigers, actually. It was one of the earliest usage of CGI. You know, tigers who were in, like, I'm trying to think of the movie where the kid is in the boat with the tiger and how that was
set. The Life of Pi.
Right, Life of Pi. Thank you. So when they had, scary animals like tigers and lions and bears, oh my, and they had them in movies, right? That was a lot of work to get a live animal like that to do what you needed it to do. And it required months of training and it required handlers and it required moving large animals all over the world in order to shoot these videos movies. And now it doesn't. And so it's,
right.
I think
and
that it's starting.
I'm really curious to see where it all goes. I mean, still you need someone to give the performance, right? The computer can't just create it on their own. So if you look at the videos we have on CNET, you actually see someone moving the mouth, right, and doing the effort of making this person actually do the acting, right? So in a lot of ways, it's almost like puppet marionettes, right?
Yeah.
Instead of having strings, the computer is actually following my face. But it's really interesting stuff, and I'm really curious to see where it goes. And I hope that it doesn't actually negatively impact our elections, even though a lot of experts expect it will. You know, my hope is that we'll get past that and we won't cause trouble. And instead, it'll really help to make entertainment better, which would be so cool.
It would be cool. And, of course, we only have just weeks to go till the election, and then we get to after the election, which I think we're all waiting for. Let's switch for a little bit and talk about something that we talk about all day long, which is COVID-19. But you wrote a story about how Apple's iOS 13.7 release includes a COVID-19 exposure notification express. This is the second time I've heard, or third time. I know Google's been working on COVID notifications. Obviously, Apple has. Tell us what you know out there.
Yeah, so Apple and Google are actually working together, which is an unusual thing if you think about how much they bitterly compete with one another. And the idea here is to actually allow people, you know, we all have sensors in our phones, and they really help us to be able to communicate, right? That's one of the great things about our phones. So Apple and Google said, well, wait a minute, why don't we have these phones communicate when we're nearby each other? And whenever they're close by, they say, hey, you know, here's a little automated anonymous identification. And what would happen is if we went all along our lives, we collected these little informations about each other, and then let's say someone gets sick in 14 days, and they go to a doctor, they have COVID, the doctor can enter in a little code into their phone, and then suddenly everyone they were nearby gets alerted, hey, you might have been exposed to coronavirus. You should get tested, or you should get yourself you should spend
quarantine
some time alone, right,
yeah.
and quarantine. And it's a really nifty idea. And so now what they've done is that in the initial versions they created after the spring, health authorities in states and in counties and in governments had to build apps to work with the system, right? Apple and Google made it all anonymous and made it safe and secure, but the health authorities had to do extra work. Now they're saying we realize that what didn't work, and instead they're going to make it so that this stuff just kind of works on its own. So if you downloaded the latest software, which came out on Tuesday, on your iPhone, you can sign up for it now. It's completely opt-in. It's not automated. You have to choose to join. And if you have an Android phone, basically not an iPhone, you can sign up in the next month or so is when the software update will come for that.
And that's actually really interesting. And I will just point out that China used WeChat, I think it was back by December or January, to put in place this kind of really extensive notification system, which I think is one way that they, you know, they of course only had to, you know, like basically flip their own switch in one place. But, you know, the idea that we can use technology and leverage it to figure out who has this and where they've been and then notify other people is, I think, a big step towards grabbing this coronavirus and just making it go away. Don't you just want it to go away, Ian? I sure do.
I think we all do. I think the challenge would be is to see who joins up with this, right? One of the questions me and a lot of other journalists have had when we've talked to Apple and Google is we've asked them, well, what percentage of people need to sign up for this? Because there's surveys out there saying that half of Americans don't even expect to get a vaccine when it comes out because they don't trust the government or the vaccine makers. So if you've got that, how many people are going to be willing to sign up for this system. And they don't know, right? We've never actually done something like this before. The last time we had a pandemic of this size was 100 years ago. And so they said, look, you know, we have a study out there that says maybe 20% of the population, if they sign up, then this will help save some lives. But I'm really curious to see when all is said and done, right, and this is the future when we write the books on this, whether or not it has any impact. Yeah. I mean, if they save one life, I think it's worth all the effort. But I'm curious to see what happens.
I am too, and I really hope it does. Ian Schur is editor-at-large of CNET.com. There are some great other stories we didn't even get to today about how Walmart Plus has introduced its new service with a $98 membership, how Uber is creating policies to protect parents, and now may actually require you to take a selfie before riding. Ian, thanks for joining us. Talk to you again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Elise Klink, sitting in for John Williams today. I'll also be around tomorrow, 9 to 1, so hope you'll join me for that, for his regular show, and, of course, the Wintrust Business Minute. You can find me online, thinklink.com, BMM, bestmoneymoves.com, my financial wellness technology company. Happy to chat with you there as well, or link in to me at LinkedIn. Happy to answer any questions you have about financial wellness, yours, your family's, others, and in that vein, there was a new study that was released today that said that half of workers, actually more than half of workers, say one reason they want to continue working in retirement is the positive influence it would have on their mental well-being. And the other reason is that they can't afford it. And you can see that in today's announcement from Ford, I think it is, that they are going to have to lay off somewhere between 1,200 and 1,400 workers. And they were surprised when they had a... they offered early retirement, not enough people took them up on it. They were like, well, who wants to take early retirement in, a pandemic and in a recession like the one that we're in? It would be very hard to find another job if you needed to continue working, even if you got that lump sum. And, of course, we do know just, from Best Money Moves and the research that we follow and conduct that people who are trying to finance their lifestyles are often borrowing from a 401k plan in order to do it. And so if you take an early buyout, you have to repay that money within 60 days, which can be very tough as well. I'm kind of wondering whether you're thinking about working in retirement and what retirement even looks like for you. And we'll probably continue this conversation tomorrow as well. But if you've got a thought about this, yes, no, whether you would, you wouldn't, you want a job, you don't want a job, or when you retire, you're really hanging up your hat and going fishing, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You could actually go and play golf as well, but it's, you don't get the fish, right? So, but anyway, what is a traditional retirement looking like these days? Early this morning, I gave a talk to Total Rewards of South Florida. They were wondering why at 6:45 a.m. I was having trouble getting the technology to work with my GoToMeeting. But anyway, talking to them about, the five generations that are now in the workforce. So one of the things that this pandemic has brought into stark relief is the idea that, there are people who are staying in the workforce a whole lot longer than they used to, right? It used to be that by 60, 65, you were really pretty much done. And now you've got people who are in their 70s, even late 70s, who are still working. And some of them are working because they want to work. Great. And some of them are working because they have to work. And so for HR, it becomes very difficult to try and provide benefits to and financial wellness benefits, of all things, to people who are in five generations, because now you've got Gen Z, that has come into the workforce the first years of that. They've just graduated, many of them, from college, and they're just, hopefully, if they haven't been withdrawn or delayed, starting their new jobs. And so you've got kids who are in, and I say kids because my kids are that age, but you've got young adults who are 22, 23, 24, 25, who are just starting in their career. And then you've got their grandparents who are in their mid to late 70s who are still coming into the office and putting in some time. And they look at benefits in different ways. They have it's interesting. You know, you might offer student loan debt and a reduction or assistance of some sort, and the young people will want it for their own stuff. And Gen X, who's in the middle, are going to want it for their own college debt that they still haven't paid off, or their graduate debt they haven't paid off. And you've got this generation that's in their 70s that sometimes they're looking to accumulate student debt help for their grandchildren or children, right? And so each generation looks at these benefit offerings from HR in a little bit of a different way. And what they're looking for, because one of the big things that employees look for these days is personalization of benefits. And so on this talk this morning from this group of HR leaders in South Florida, one of the questions was, well, how do you personalize when you've got this disparity of ages? Because it's different by, you know, generation. It's different by all kinds of things. And so when you think about, you know, retirement, for example, or retirement readiness, the game completely changes. You know, if you are in, let's say, automotive and you're working in a factory, or if you're in the service industry and you're sitting behind a desk all day, or if you're in healthcare, right? It all looks a little bit different. And so, you know, when you've got this disparity of ages, helping them all figure out what retirement readiness looks like and getting them ready to retire before they're in their late 70s, is typically a goal for HR. It's just kind of interesting to think about how and why people continue to work and why they don't take the Ford layoff, or excuse me, the Ford early retirement option, right? Because a lot of times they can't. John joins us on the line now. Hey, John, so when did you actually retire?
I retired back in 75. I mean, 2015.
And how old were you?
I was 75 at the time.
That sounds good. And why did you stay?
Well, actually, I wanted to save some money so that I could retire and have a nice retirement. Don't have to worry about, you know, paying my bills and being able to do a little vacation with my wife. And my passion is golf. Go out and play golf. And unfortunately, I had to go back to work on a part-time basis, because when you retire and you reach age 75 and 71 and a half, the government tells you you need to take out 10% of all your savings.
Right.
So in order to save that money, I had to go back and get a part-time job so that I could put that money into a Roth account.
Got it. And so are you still working part-time?
No, I finally retired 2 years ago. And unfortunately, with this COVID thing, I have to help my kids. Now they're out of work because of the COVID.
Yep.
They can, you know, so now I'm supporting two of my kids still that are married and have kids. And I was all, there goes my retirement. It's going to helping these kids.
Oh, no. Well, John, I hope your kids are able to get jobs. We are seeing an improvement in that market, and it is so incredibly important that everybody, you know, have an opportunity to contribute and have work. And I hope that you are able to get back to your retirement pretty soon. But great example of exactly what I'm talking about, which is that people need to have the opportunity to, you know, really retire. And there's a lot of reasons why you just can't, whether it's you want a better retirement or any retirement at all, or you have to go back because you can get a job, but your kids just can't. Thanks so much for your call. All right, it is 12:41. We're going to do the Wintrust Business Minute, and here's Steve Bertrand.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. The Cubs have signed a long-term partnership with sports betting giant DraftKings. It could become the largest individual sportsbook in the country and one of the first betting operations at an actual sports venue in the country. Researchers at the Illinois Institute of Technology have developed a new brain implant technology that aims to help bring sight to the blind. It's landed a grant from the National Institutes of Health to begin clinical trials. Chicago Window says it's received $2.5 million. And the former chief technology officer at Expedia is a co-founder of Nest Egg. That's a Chicago startup to help small business landlords collect rent, manage maintenance requests, and streamline mortgage and loan payments. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
Orion, you've got better news with agri-markets?
A little better news, but not quite so much. The September wheat contract is trading 5 cents lower per bushel. The September corn contract is down 4¾ cents. And the September soybean contract is trading higher by half a penny. So not much change in the agricultural community as well. But we do have more sales to report. China has been active again today. Today, China bought 132,000 tons of U.S. soybeans. And it usually is 318,000 tons of soybeans going to an unknown destination. So the purchases are continuing, not to the degree that the Phase 1 trade agreement said it should, but at least they are doing some buying. And, of course, the COVID-19 situation continues to impact a lot of agriculture. I received a note yesterday from the Lake County Fair Association. They're seeking written proposals from interested parties for naming rights sponsorship of the event center on the Lake County, Illinois Fairgrounds. That's located at 1060 East Peterson Road, and the Lake County Fairgrounds and Event Center is a popular area destination for some high-profile year-round events and activities. So if you're interested in holding an event in their fairgrounds and enough of events there to name it after your company, get in touch with the Lake County Fair Association at Grays Lake, Illinois. And, of course, county fairs canceled or postponed, and one of the most popular county fairs in the Chicago area, the Sandwich Fair, which has been running for well over a century, but it would be starting on Monday. It will not. No Sandwich Fair this year. And the Illinois Agricultural Leadership Foundation Board of Directors has unanimously voted to delay in-person seminars for the class of 2022. During this delay, the Ag Leadership plans to launch a monthly webinar series featuring prominent speakers discussing relevant topics. Series will be open to the class of 2022 IALP alumni and the supporters of the Illinois Agricultural Leadership Foundation. And the series intended as an opportunity for extended learning and building connections with fellow alumni and new class members, and information on the decision to extend and more on the webinar series can be found at the website of the Illinois Agricultural Leadership Foundation. My, what a different year we're having because of the pandemic. That's your money on 720 WGN.
Stock market is down 845 points right now. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for John Williams. Find me online. ThinkLink.com, BestMoneyMoves.com, and WGN reporter Amy Guth joins me online right now. Hey, Amy, how are things going today?
Great. How are you? Nice to hear from you.
It's nice to have you back on the show. So, you know, lots of news to talk about today. I think what I want to start with is the airlines. We're seeing, because we had unemployment numbers this morning, the weekly jobless claims of about 881,000. And we get the big number tomorrow, what the monthly unemployment number looks like. But the airlines are just struggling, right? This month we've seen American announce layoffs. Southwest is doing buyouts, another code word for layoffs. And then today, United. What are you hearing?
Yeah, you know, this is something I'm watching the airlines closely, especially since the start of when the pandemic really started hitting the U.S. And I think all have just watched just the impact that it's had with travel, you know, nearly coming to a shutdown at one point, and travel numbers still really, really dismal. So this is not unexpected, but it is slightly lower than originally anticipated. United has said they plan to cut 16,000 jobs. Now, the reason that number is a little bit lower is because, like many other airlines, they turned to their workers and said, hey, we're going to offer some voluntary buyouts, and a lot of people took advantage of that. So, but still, what I'm really interested in is what happens October 1st. When that federal funding, when that federal relief came through for airlines earlier this year, to help offset that huge revenue plunge that we saw earlier in the pandemic cycle, part of that, receiving that money, was you cannot lay anybody off until the end of September. So now that we're in September, it's getting real, and people are starting to get a little nervous about, okay, well, you know, we could have thousands and thousands of airline workers temporarily, you know, potentially out of work starting October 1st. So I'm really interested in what all the airlines are doing right now. We saw United cut some baggage handling fee or some change fees. We saw, you know, these numbers have been coming about how many staff reductions we can expect and just how that's changing. We also saw from American earlier this week a huge cut in their service routes, about a 55% cut to some of the routes that we know are always there several times a day, and then a little bit of a change to some routes to some warmer destinations from colder cities. So I think airlines are going to look really different for a little while, and I think leadership of airlines have kind of had that in mind all the while. Pretty early in this, they were the ones that kind of came out ahead of it going, you know what, I don't think this is going to be that V-shaped recovery. I think what's happened here, because we've been hit so badly, is we're probably looking at 2019 travel levels not really coming back and not having that solvency until probably 2023-2024, which
wow.
is really feeling like a long way off. But that really, to me, illustrates the extent of the damage to airlines.
Well, I'm the perfect reason why this is happening, right? You know, we're seeing some personal travel come back, but business travel just isn't coming back. I would go to a conference every single week. I'd speak around the country, do international travel, take a big trip at the end of the year with my family. We were in Vietnam last year. Every year we try to do that. Nothing this year. In fact, I haven't literally left Chicago or been to the airport since March 10th when I went for a day trip to Boston, and yet I was on the road every single week. And everybody I know who also is flying all over the place for business isn't. Their business travel has been shut down officially through the end of the year and possibly even earlier into next year. When you have a company like Google say nobody's coming back to the office till June 1st, what they're not saying, or July 1st, you know, what they're not saying there is, of course, and nobody's going to any conferences, so don't invite us. And that really is, I think, one of the big pieces of the travel sort of meltdown that isn't being discussed.
Yeah, I totally agree. I completely agree. And airlines have long kind of categorized business travel differently than leisure travel and even that luxury travel where people are going to buy that first-class leisure travel ticket. But business travel really holds this special place revenue-wise for airlines, and I think that has been such a major impact for them. Now, I agree. I think that, you know, a piece of that related to that is what we saw from the numbers that were just released from Zoom this week.
Incredible
numbers from Zoom, and it's not a surprise at all because so many businesses have said, okay, this isn't maybe a temporary fix, maybe this is the way we do business now. And so I think a lot of what we used to spend going to conferences or flying across the world to do a deal might be funneled into our technology now, which, you know, that's a whole other conversation, but to me, just kind of pointing at another way in which the world has changed possibly for quite a while.
No, it has. And then leading into it, I mean, all of these kinds of things, like this big major disruption in business travel, has profound implications for a company like Land's End. And I know that you know, Bloomberg had a story today about how Land's End, which is one of the uniform industry's biggest providers, something I didn't even realize, is also seeing the effects of the flight being grounded and students wearing sweats.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think it's been very interesting to see all of these kind of ancillary industries impacted. But the uniform industry really speaks to how badly hit the very industries we were just talking about. You know, think about people who wear uniforms in hotels, in airplanes. Like, there's a lot of people that use uniforms. Add in students. Add in, you know, all these groups, all these stakeholders that would be wearing uniforms. So Lands' End said their uniform sales fell almost 43% last quarter. And as one of the industry's biggest providers of uniforms, that's a big hit there. Now, they say the rest of their business areas, you know, they do plenty of things that are not uniforms, and they feel like those are strong results there. But that's, to me, that really speaks to exactly how hard these industries are being hit when we're seeing, okay, the people that were wearing uniforms are not wearing those uniforms. That's students, that's workers, that's pilots, you know, that's all these people. And that is really reflecting on those industries that are struggling so badly right now.
I got to tell you, one of the great memories that I have about Lands' End is I was saying this to Pete Zimmerman, our producer, earlier during one of the breaks. This is a company where it was my go-to for baby gifts. They offer these wonderful towels with appliques, you know, like little fire trucks or flowers or whatever, and you can monogram the kid's name underneath and you send it out. And I don't know, it was like 25 or 30 bucks or something with the monogram included. Very affordable and lovely gift that apparently lasted, because I had somebody who said to me, oh, you know that baby gift you gave me? Well, my kid's going to college now and they're taking that towel with them. So that's what I think about with Lands' End. And it was so surprising to me that they had really branched into the uniform world. But, you know, again, not a great time to be doing uniforms.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and you also have to think about restaurant workers in uniforms. And just once you start thinking of how many people would be buying uniforms if they were working, it really starts to kind of show you the size of it. And with Lands' End as one of the biggest providers, I think their numbers are showing exactly how big of a scale we're talking about.
Well, Amy, thanks for dropping by today. We will talk to you again very soon. Amy Guth is the WGN reporter. Nice to talk to you.
Nice talking to you. Thanks so much.